Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening and welcome to Cure Talk. I'm Shweta Mishra, your host, joining you from India. And this evening on Cure Talk's 114th episode, we are discussing multidisciplinary care of melanoma, more commonly called skin cancer. No one knows your skin better than you do, and you will be the first one to notice any changes occurring there. Melanoma is a type of cancer that develops from melanocytes that are the pigment-containing cells in our body. Melanomas typically occur in the skin, but may rarely occur in mouth, intestines, or eye. According to the National Institute of Health, melanoma is amongst the most common U.S. cancers, with nearly 1 million people already living with the disease, and more than 76,000 new cases and 10,000 deaths expected in 2016. So it is imperative to be educated about the causes and early signs of a disease that affects the largest organ of our body. On this launch show on melanoma, we are having facial plastic and reconstructive surgeon and otolaryngologist Dr. Jeffrey Moyer of University of Michigan Health System to talk about the common risk factors and latest treatments available for melanoma. Dr. Moyer will also discuss the importance of plastic surgery in the treatment of melanoma with our melanoma panel led by David Stanley. Dr. Moyer earned his medical degree with highest honors in 1997 at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. In 2003, he joined the University of Michigan's Cancer Center, where he performs reconstructive surgery for head and neck cancer. His research focuses on immunological therapy of head and neck cancer. Dr. Moyer is board certified by the American Board of Otolaryngology and the American Board of Facial Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery, in addition to being an active member of the American Academy of Facial Plastic and Reconstructive Surgeons, the American Academy of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery, the American College of Surgeons, the American Association for Cancer Research, and the American Head and Neck Society. I welcome you to the show, Dr. Moyer. It's a pleasure to have you to talk to us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great. My co-host for today's show My co-host for today's show is David L. Stanley. David is a Flint, Michigan-based writer, teacher, voiceover actor, and audiobook narrator. His book, Melanoma, It Started with a Freckle, was published in 2016 and was rated number one as a new release in dermatology. More details on his book is available on his Facebook page at Melanoma Book. Stanley writes regularly for dadsroundtable.com and speaks regularly on cancer advocacy issues. His freelance work has appeared in Bridge.com, JTA, Moment, Road, and Velo magazines, and his work on the Flint water crisis was featured on NPR's Here and Now. His voiceover work can be heard on myvoiceovermasters.com. We also have with us on our panel patient number one, TJ Sharp from South Jersey. TJ Sharp is a stage four melanoma patient who shares his journey through cancer in the patient number one blog on www.philly.com. Diagnosed in August 2012 with melanoma tumors in multiple organs. Since then, he has had six surgeries and four immunotherapy treatments over two different clinical trials. His is a story about life with serious illness and mental and emotional hurdles a patient must clear. TJ writes about challenges a cancer patient comes across while overcoming melanoma's long odds and deadly consequences. He also shares the latest melanoma and cancer research breakthroughs and advocacy initiatives to help others detect or educate themselves on cancer. I welcome you to the show, David and TJ, and I extend a very warm welcome to all our listeners. And before we begin, I would like to remind that we will be discussing questions sent in via email at the end of the show. So you can send your questions to priya@trialx.com. And if you want to ask a question live, please press one on your keypads and we will bring you live on air to ask them. Or you can also post your questions on CureTalk's website as you listen to the show. So with this, I will hand it over to you, David. Please, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Shweta. TJ, thanks for joining us. Good to hear from you. Pleasure to be here. Thank you. Yep. And Dr. Moyer, appreciate you taking an hour out of your day to share some expertise and maybe some good news or two about what's going on right now in melanoma treatment.
Thanks very much for having me.
Pleasure's all ours. And by the way, as disclaimer here, Dr. Moyer is the surgeon who operated on me, although the relationship is professional. It's not like, you know, we're hanging out doing triathlons together or anything. So I just want to put that out there right in the front. And I've been in Dr. Moyer's office on many occasions. And one thing I noticed, Dr. Moyer, is you don't just do cancer surgery. You're also very involved in a lot of cosmetic surgery. And it really struck me when I was in the office for the first time, the difference in your patient load. And I wonder if you could talk about that, because I know you're really strong in cancer treatment areas, but the idea of working in cosmetic dermatology, cosmetic surgery, is also really interesting, that juxtaposition.
Yeah, in many ways, at least from the standpoint of surgery, the similarities are quite, there are quite a lot of similarities. And so when you're really trying to reconstruct someone after cancer surgery, there's a lot of the same principles that you follow even when you're doing cosmetic surgery. I think, though, one of the most important things, though, that anybody that does both of those practices really needs to keep in mind, though, is that oncology is always the most important thing. That means making sure the tumor is completely removed. And so one of the things I always teach our residents and fellows here is that oncology really trumps the cosmesis. And so that making sure that cancer is fully removed and effectively removed is by far the most important thing.
Is that the cancer surgery that you're involved in right now, is that forming a major portion of your practice these days?
I would say probably about half my practice is aesthetic surgery and about the other half is reconstructive surgery. It's
okay. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say it's kind of an evenly mixed.
Okay. Now, I had left a copy of my book with you, and in it I wrote a lot about the psychological trauma because, you know, facial surgery is scary as all hell, and it has the possibility for some disfigurement. And the psychological impact on me was a lot stronger than any of the real medical impact because I was stage 2 and in relatively good shape from an oncological standpoint. You are a pretty stand-up guy. You're always straightforward, and you know, I was really struck by that. How do you help your patients deal with all the psychological effects that come along with head and neck surgery for cancer?
Well, I think you're really very apropos about pointing out what a lot of people face, and in many ways, the psychology of the diagnosis of a melanoma cancer is very, very powerful. And I think as all of our patients know that have had a melanoma diagnosis, I think many people fear that it's going to come back. And so that is really something that you really have to work with patients. And I think it's very, very difficult because, I mean, none of us have a crystal ball. But, I mean, you just have to be very, very supportive of patients. And one of the nice things that we have in 2016 is very, very effective treatments for people who wind up developing metastatic disease or disease that spreads outside of the original melanoma and out to other parts of the body. And these have become very, very effective. So I think making sure that people understand there are lots of treatments available and making sure that they are constantly following themselves for evidence of recurrence are all kind of that process.
Right. TJ, you had mentioned to me before the show that you were very curious about immunotherapies. And I think this is something that, that Dr. Moyer's working up to. Would you like to ask Dr. Moyer what you were talking about in terms of immunotherapy as the next wave of melanoma treatment?
Sure, David, thanks. There's a couple things. I've been on immunotherapies in both of my trials and certainly have embraced melanoma being at the forefront of kind of this new wave of treatments. A couple questions. Maybe the first one to start with, if I were a patient, well, I'm a patient, but if I were a newly diagnosed melanoma patient, how do I go about selecting the right immunotherapy, or maybe even more, a little more detailed, the right series or combinations of immunotherapies?
An area that I have a great deal of expertise in the sense that I'm not a medical oncologist. I will tell you that, at least for the listeners, I think there's a real important distinction as we talk about melanoma. Without question, by far the best treatment. Where immunotherapy and other type of therapies come into use are really for that patient population who has systemic disease, for patients whose melanoma has spread outside of, say, a spot on their arm or a spot on their face. And so it's really the biggest advances have occurred in treating those types of patients, those patients with systemic disease. So to really kind of answer your question about trying to decide about immunotherapy, it really circles back to really having a very good workup initially. So it has to do with that first surgical treatment, diagnosis, and an effective surgical treatment. And age a patient. That means there is evidence of disease other parts of the body.
Now, Dr. Boyer, you're cutting in and out just a skosh here, so I hope I'm not interrupting you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you well.
Okay, good. Now, I'm old enough, because I'm 58. I remember that media madness around interferon back in 1980, cover of Time magazine, cover of Newsweek magazine. And I remember those first kind of misguided gene therapy tests back in 1990 that actually had horrible patient outcomes. So really strong promise here, but not such great results. Do you feel, and what, it's clear you're pretty bullish on immunotherapy. What exactly, first of all, explain to our listeners what immunotherapy is, and then why you're bullish on immunotherapy.
Well, I mean, I guess I'll answer the question of why I think it's getting so much attention. Is it really is the first event that we have actually seen for the treatment of melanoma that really has moved the needle on survival. So
okay.
when you're talking about, you know, distant metastatic melanoma, when the survivals historically were so poor, that there are patients now that are where melanoma diagnosis with distant disease, it's almost like a chronic disease. I have a number of patients in my practice that if they had had this diagnosis 15 years ago, they would not still be with us. But because of
right.
the advent of these newer immunotherapeutic regimens, that actually changed things dramatically. And so immunotherapy is really a broad term that applies to a lot of different approaches to revving up the immune system to fight off cancer. In fact, immunotherapy is a very, very old concept that has been around since the turn of the 20th century, back in the early 1900s. And it's only been fairly recently where we've seen immunotherapy has really kind of found its own place in oncological treatment. And the newest immunotherapies are really acting a pathway where they're putting most therapy drugs are taking the brakes off of the immune system. There is always this constant play in the body between having too much immunity or too little immunity. And a lot of these medications are taking breaks off of the immune response so that they can be more effective at destroying cancer cells.
Now, when I was doing research for my book, one of the things that a couple different people in dermatology mentioned to me is that melanoma is very, very good at camouflaging itself under normal circumstances, cancerous melanocytes, from the body's own immune system. What are we doing differently that's finally allowing our body's immune system to take action against those?
I don't think we really – I don't think there's a great answer to that question.
Okay.
The concept of using immunotherapy as a treatment against tumors is obviously – I mean, there's other tumors that are this therapy is being used against, other solid type tumors like lung cancer, colon cancer. But the results have been kind of mixed in those other cancers. So it probably has something to do that's unique with melanoma. It's been a tumor that has been a bit more responsive to immunotherapeutic regimens. Even, as you pointed out, the interferon. Interferon, though a very toxic treatment, actually was effective in a small subgroup of patients. Unfortunately, we didn't really see those same effects in other types of tumors, and it was tried.
Got it.
Oma.
Yeah. Now, you had mentioned earlier when you were talking to TJ about the importance of a really good workup in the staging process and so on. TJ, now, when you were diagnosed the first time, did you have a sentinel node biopsy?
The only biopsy I had on my lymph nodes was actually during the resection. So they did take the lymph nodes out of my arm, but not as a separate procedure.
Okay. I was, again, in doing some research, I found a paper by Dr. Tanis about the development of sentinel node biopsies. And it seems, Dr. Moyer, that has become a pretty useful diagnostic tool for that initial workup. Can you explain what exactly a sentinel node biopsy is and when it's indicated and how your findings from that biopsy might affect you, what kind of surgical procedures your patients would have?
Sure, absolutely. So really it has to do with the concept that melanoma wants to spread and the likelihood of melanoma spreading to other parts of the body is a function of how deep the melanoma is in the skin, and we call that the Breslow depth.
Okay.
So one of the important diagnostic studies is that biopsy that tells us how deep that melanoma is. And we know from studies that have been done that the likelihood of melanoma spreading increases as the depth of that melanoma increases. And we also know that at a certain there is not really significant risk of the melanoma spreading. So there is a cutoff in terms of when we think about how likely it is for the melanoma to spread. And so it's that cutoff that is, it's not arbitrarily set. It's been looked at over large bits of data, but if it's sampling right. Someone's lymph nodes and to see whether or not evidence of melanoma in those lymph nodes. The controversy, I think, around sentinel node has to do with whether or not it's really a prognostic test that it's just used to determine whether or not there is a higher likelihood of people having distant disease and in some ways predicting survival, or is it actually therapeutic treatment, meaning that if you do remove the lymph nodes in a draining basin, like JT had in his axilla, whether or not that is actually beneficial rather than just prognostic. And so that's where things are right now. I think that most node biopsy, if the node is positive, followed by a subsequent do better, have the lymph nodes removed.
Now, TJ, did you have the lymph nodes removed in any of, I know you had I mean, we're going to give you a chance in a little bit to share a little bit of your personal story, and I know it's pretty you have a really significant surgical history, I'm sad to say. But did you have any of your lymph nodes? You said there was a biopsy as part of the procedure. Did you have significant lymph nodes removed during any of those surgeries you went through?
Yes, and it was actually on my first melanoma. The stage 4 diagnosis was technically a re-diagnosis of a melanoma from 12 years prior. The first surgery, when I was 25, did remove the area around the mole that tested positive for melanoma, and they took all the lymph nodes out of my one underarm where theoretically would have spread if it were to metastasize. So I had all those removed, and while I was still under, they did a very quick slice test. Dr. Moore could probably give the better term for it, but they quickly tested it for metastases. There was none, and in the follow-up test, there was no metastases as well. So I was staged it at 1B kind of after the surgery, and I kind of kept going on after that, thinking that I had removed it. And as you'll hear in a few minutes, it was still inside me 12 years later.
Got it. And that actually, that kind of brings us back to a question I wanted to ask Dr. Moyer as far as surgical choices. Dr. Moyer, when I had mine done, and I think this was like 2006, 2007, you and the rest of the team at U of M decided right from the outset to do a square procedure. We'd heard a lot up until then about Mohs surgery, and I hear like on message boards and support groups and whatnot, there's a lot of confusion between the two and where they're indicated. Could you speak to that for a couple minutes, please?
Sure. It's a bit. I think the best way to think about it, talking and kind of painting in broad strokes, is
exactly
that,
what I want to hear.
Yeah, so Mohs surgery, in most instances, is really designed for patients with basal cell carcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, in very with using frozen sections to look at whether or not the cancer is all completely removed. People will remove melanoma using permanent sections because it's hard to look at melanoma under frozen.
Okay.
There are certain types of melanomas where there are some dermatological surgeons doing Mohs surgery for certain types of melanomas. But as a general rule, most people are doing permanent sections, like without frozen sections, which is what Mohs is.
Right. Because one of the things I remember, Dr. Matt Ludgate was the fellow who was doing the biopsies for prior to my square procedure, and it was usually a day or two after Dr. Ludgate did the biopsies before they could get results back, because he stressed that there were certain kinds of cytological things that had to be done to those cells before you could get a really good melanoma diagnosis of whether it was free of precancerous cells. Does that ring true still today?
It does, and the type of melanoma that you had is typically arises in chronically sun-damaged skin.
And that was me, yeah.
And what is different about these kind of type of melanomas that arise in the head and neck that are in chronically sun-damaged skin is very often there is subclinical extension. And so that's where that square technique comes in to try to map out the margins. That's a bit different and other types of melanoma that are found on the trunk and extremities, where a fairly standard margin is obtained, usually 1 to 2 centimeters, depending upon where the location is. So there isn't that as much of that concern about the sub-spread melanomas totally removed. So there's a little bit of a distinction between that and melanomas that happen at other parts of the body.
That's really interesting to me, because we're seeing this big spike in melanoma, and we're seeing this big correlation between skin cancer in a can, tanning machines. But are we seeing a similar kind of spike in melanoma that is not related to overexposure to the sun?
I mean, I think that most people would agree that most melanoma is associated with sun exposure. I think trying to flesh it all out is complicated because it requires large, populations to study. But I think most people would agree that it's sun-related and that it probably has to do a little bit more with acute sun injury rather than chronicity, meaning that people who had a really bad sunburn tend to be probably at greater or at the greatest risk, though there certainly is a component to chronic sun injury as well.
Okay. TJ, you had a couple questions that we had talked about in terms of detection. Would you like to toss those at Dr. Moyer right now?
Yes, and this is partially for my own knowledge, but also partially for the audience to kind of hear some of the things I've heard before. The first is the frequency with which to go to a dermatologist, and then following up to that in between visits, what do I do to keep myself and to keep vigilant, to look for things on my skin that would keep me aware of anything that might be a problem?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and a lot of it depends upon, what you would tell one person would be different than what you would tell another person. For someone like yourself, or anybody that's had a history of melanoma, they're certainly at greater risk of developing another one, and so having frequent skin checks is really, really important. I mean, self-exams are critically important, but also having someone else that examine you in areas you can't really see, because you can't really see at the top of your scalp, you can't see your back very easily, the back of your legs, and so having those full-body skin checks are really important in addition to doing your own skin checks and also feeling the lymph nodes near the area where you had the original melanoma diagnosis. I think frequency of checks with a practitioner, with a physician, is always a bit sketchy because you don't really know, but I think most people would say that are at higher risk to check every 6 months for a period of time. And then how long you do every 6 months really depends on the patient.
If I can jump in here, my local dermatologist is a fellow, Walt Barkey, and Walt wrote the foreword to my book. And one of the things Walt really urges is that when you go in for your skin check with him, that you bring in your partner or a close friend, and he will actually, because there's such a shortage of frontline dermatologists in most communities now, he will actually walk you and your partner through the exam. And obviously he's not going to teach them how to diagnose melanoma, but he is going to say, okay, this is something that you don't need to be concerned about. You do need to be concerned about this. And he will get you involved in kind of a partnership with you and your partner, so that you don't have to worry about constant access to a dermatologist, which in a lot of communities can be very difficult. Here in Genesee County in Michigan, we have 5 board-certified dermatologists for a population of 500,000 people.
Yeah, I think that's really, really a great thing to have people do. You teach them. I mean, and a lot of these lesions are found by patients or patients' family members, so you're absolutely right to actually have someone in that exam room kind of with you.
Did you hear about the swimmer just the other day who someone noticed an interesting-looking lesion on him and got in touch with him and said, that's a weird-looking thing on you. You better have a look at it. He has melanoma.
Is that right? Who was that?
Yes, it just broke like 2-3 days ago. I saw it on ESPN. Some world-class swimmer. And I also had I have a friend who was at a barbecue, and she was standing there, and a guy walked up to her and he said, "I don't really mean to be rude," he said, "but I'm a derm resident, and you have something on the back of your knee that needs to be examined." And it turns out that she also had melanoma on the back of her leg.
Interesting. Yeah, I just Googled it. It's Mac Horton.
Yeah, that's him. Right. That's the name. Exactly.
Australian Olympic medalist.
Yeah. And in Australia, of course, they call it their national disease. When you move all of those fair-skinned British people 150 years ago with no melanin in their skin for protection down to Australia, well, you're going to have a little bit of melanoma, I suspect, and other skin cancers as well. TJ, you had some questions about other kinds of prevention tips, too. You might not know Dr. Moyer is a runner and a triathlete. Could you speak to that, you and TJ, about prevention for people who are out there a lot in the sunshine?
Sure. I would not call myself a triathlete, but I was able to do my first triathlon this spring. And living in South Florida makes training interesting when you are, dually competing for trying to get, faster times and keep yourself safe from the sun during all those training runs and swims, especially. Other than, I think everybody knows wear sunscreen. The first question might be, to reiterate, how often, how much, and then following up with that, one thing that I've, I don't want to say struggled with, but one thing that has been a constant adjustment for me is what to do on those long sunny days where, you mentioned earlier, it's not so much the constant sun exposure, but the one day where you're out there and you forget your sunscreen or you're not wearing a shirt or something, give us some good preventative tips to keep that sunburn from getting from happening on a on a nice South Florida spring day here.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I struggle with the same issues myself because if you're out, particularly if you're racing, if you're on a big race and, sometimes you're worried about your time and just staying on the bike and just trying finishing rather than making sure you slather yourself with sunscreen. I do think that there has been a concerted effort by a lot of the race organizers to really make sure that that sunscreen's readily available throughout the race course. I know when I did several of my Ironmans, at stations, not only could you get water and refuel with food, but you could also get sunscreen. And so I think that, tacitly recognizing that this is as important as food on these races, I think is important. There are certainly clothing that you can wear that is sun blocking. As a general rule, not to kind of pile on triathletes, but we're particularly bad about it because the type of clothes we wear, because you're swimming, then you're biking, and then you're running, and a lot of the clothes are not very protective of the sun. But I think if we, in many ways, we'd be well served by making sure we're better protected, certainly during training rides, because you're out there for long, long periods of time. But as you pointed out, these races, you can get burned. You can't really say don't race, but short of making sure that you keep yourself slathered with sunscreen and making sure you keep yourself covered, there's not a lot to do. There is some advantages to racing in climates like Michigan, where at least when you're racing, riding in the fall, you're a little bit more bundled up. And you have yourself covered. But if you're in a hot environment like South Florida, it's difficult.
I remember years ago, I raced bicycles for a long time, and for six or seven of those years, I was doing it essentially for a living. So I was on a bike for, 20 or so hours, maybe more, a week in training. And Lycra is not very sun protective. There's no sun protection factor in Lycra at all. We one year had jerseys that had a white V in the middle of them, and the rest of it was a pale orange. And if you didn't wear a T-shirt under your jersey, you would come back with a sunburned V on your back where the sun had just beat right through the big white V on your jersey. And so you could tell everybody who rode for Fuji, because with our shirts off, we were pretty clearly labeled as Fuji riders. So I don't know if this is really a little bit out of your area of medical expertise, but what's your take on the sun protection factors that some clothing lines are putting out there for outdoorsmen, you know, like fishermen, and for cyclists and runners as well? Have you seen much data about their effectiveness yet?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great, I've done a little bit of research on the SPF of various sunscreens, and when you really look at what they promise is not really what they deliver. So if I extrapolate what I know about kind of the standard sun protection, which is sunscreen, to clothing, I would suspect that it's probably pretty similar. At some level, I think any sunblock is good sunblock. I don't know if, you know, when you read those labels and they say SPF X, Y, or Z, I don't know if you can really put much stock in that. I don't think the data really are known.
Consumer Reports says you can't. You know, they sent that stuff out to several different labs. And this was, I think, about a year or so ago. TJ, you're really up on that because so much of your readership of your blog kind of depends on you for that sort of information. I don't know if you can comment on that or not, but do you remember seeing that article about how wildly off base so many of those SPF numbers were?
I did see that, and that's the that's part of the reason my question was in there, is that, you know, relying on you know, SPF 100 to, you know, promote itself as you know, as a much stronger thing than maybe SPF 30, really isn't that much better and isn't really, you know, your sole line of defense. I've seen the article, and, you know, unfortunately I don't have the science behind it, other than to share with, you know, listeners and especially friends and family here that come to South Florida, that, you know, there's, you know, it's a multi-layer approach, literally and figuratively, that, you know, sunscreen is a good first step, but it's not something that you should rely on, and certainly not the only thing that will prevent, not the only thing you can do to prevent a sunburn. So, you know, I encourage, you know, my family, our friends, and people that I discuss this with, is that, you know, there's kind of be, you know, a couple of things. Put on some sunscreen, wear a hat, put on the long sleeve shirt, stay out of the sun when it's middle of the day. You know, the kind of the basics that I've heard throughout the last couple of years.
Got it. I want to give a shout out here to a couple organizations, and I don't know if you've done any work with them, Dr. Moyer. One of them is Outrun the Sun. It's a melanoma awareness organization out of Indianapolis. They stage a 5 and a 10K every year. And I was down there for a book signing over the summer, and they staged their event in the evening.
That's great.
They make a big deal about
idea.
Yeah, about why they do it. And then they were also the folks who gave away, I don't know how many hundreds of gallons of sunscreen at the entry to the Indy 500, both the IndyCar race and the NASCAR race. Every gate had essentially unlimited free sunscreen for all of those folks who are going to be just baking inside that, you know, inside that racetrack for 4, 5, 6 hours or more on the course of a car race day. And there's also the New England Melanoma Foundation. I think I'm getting the name a little wrong. They are providing free sunscreen at selected ski areas throughout New England. And there's also a group in Colorado that's doing the same thing at select ski areas in Colorado as well, where when you get to the bottom, you know, typically a ski area, they might be, you know, there's some Kleenexes there and trail maps. Well, now there's also going to be sunscreen, because at, you know, 7,000 feet in the Rocky Mountains, that's a huge present danger. So there's a lot of awareness out there finally about how to frontline protection, so to speak. I want to ask Dr. Moyer, I want to ask you one more question, and then I believe we have, it looks like 6 or 8 questions that have been emailed in. And TJ, I want to make sure he has a chance to tell a bit of his story and get your response to that too. Now, I've done a little bit of evolutionary biology. My academic background is in zoology. And so we see this evidence that shows that cancer cells, just like every living thing, respond to selective pressures, you know, evolutionary pressures, just like penicillin during World War II. 20 years later, we see penicillin, methicillin resistance. So if we assume for an instant that immunotherapy continues to evolve as a really effective treatment, two-part question. Do you think you will see, as a surgeon, fewer frontline cases of surgery as we get better at dealing with immunotherapy? And the second question is,
if indeed those melanocytes are under selective pressure to survive that immunotherapy, might we see the rise of a really even more devastating version of melanoma? That's kind of, you know, that's you know, science fiction perhaps, but what do you think is going to happen with immunotherapy and surgery in your practice?
Well, I think, I mean, again, I think probably it won't dramatically change what is essentially frontline treatment, which is surgery, because either you're really not going to be putting people on immunotherapy to prevent the development of melanoma. I mean, we haven't really got into it much in the discussion, but a lot of these immunotherapeutic medications have some significant side effects. They work wonders, and they're great medications, but like any medication, there are some serious side effects. So it's really hard to see a situation, certainly in the near term, where you would kind of prophylactically put somebody on an immunotherapeutic regimen to prevent the development of melanoma. So really what you're still looking at is someone who develops melanoma and then being sure that you diagnose them very early, treat them effectively, and then if they are at risk of developing metastasis or distant disease, then instituting immunotherapy. So I think that will probably be more of a paradigm going forward than, it, you know, kind of supplanting surgery.
Okay, and the second part of that, like I said, sounds a little bit like science fiction and the development of superbugs, but we didn't necessarily see that coming with penicillin resistance either. Can you foresee an instance where we might have essentially a melanoma supercell that might result as because they have survived these repeated attacks of immunotherapy?
Certainly there always is a concern in an individual, not so much in a population, but in an individual that is being treated with a immunotherapeutic regimen or any type of small molecule therapy or even chemotherapy, that you select out the most resistant cells. And I think that is a concern with immunotherapy as well. So, you know, it's still, we're in our infancy in really understanding how people respond to these various treatment regimens. I think the hope is that if you can combine these medications, if you can combine different types of immunotherapy, combine different types of immunotherapy, say, with other kind of frontline medications treating melanoma, such as like BRAF inhibitors or something like that, or maybe some other types of medications we don't even really know about yet, that's limited. But I think as you look at a whole population, I don't worry about, you know, if you treat, you know, patients, you know, in one part of the country that is going to make melanoma different than another part of the country. But you always worry about that in individual patients.
Now, TJ, you had several courses of immunotherapy, correct?
That is correct.
And so talk about that for a few minutes. What brought you to immunotherapy? What kind of side effects, if any, did you have? And I'm really interested in the psychological effects of that, too, because I've been through a lot of surgery, and I was fortunate that it essentially worked the first time. You have an entirely different take on melanoma. So I'm really curious about the psychological aspect of a patient who's been through surgery and then is told that they're going to need immunotherapy.
When I was first re-diagnosed, my wife and I just had our second child, and I was in the hospital 4 weeks later, and the doctor, who is not a melanoma specialist, is a general oncologist, did not know much about clinical research, certainly hadn't been up to date with what was going on in the immunotherapy world, kind of came in with my tumor's genetic report and said, here's the best options for you chemotherapy-wise. You're not eligible for this targeted therapy, so, you know, kind of good luck, you know. And he had made the comment that, you know, he'd be surprised if I were here in 2 years, and that sort of set off my, okay, that's not going to be acceptable. You know, my son is a month old at this point, and, you know, I had read enough and I had known enough about clinical trials and about melanoma to kind of get myself somewhere where, okay, you know, the standard of care chemo had, you know, pretty dismal 5-year survival rates, and I was, other than melanoma, I was relatively healthy.
Right.
You know, I was a younger guy, and
had been keeping myself in pretty decent shape. Very little in my medical history suggested that I couldn't, I could withstand a little bit or be able to hopefully get a reaction as we started looking into immunotherapy. So, we did four different second opinions, and we finally found one of the world class melanoma researchers, and he kind of gave me two options. I said, what would you do if you were 37 and you had a young family that needed you to be there, and you wanted to give yourself the best chance for a durable long term response? And he kind of gave me a choice of one of the anti PD-1 inhibitors, or another one where it was ipilimumab, which is an immunotherapy with TIL sort of shoved in the middle. TIL is what's called tumor infiltrating lymphocytes, where a tumor is pulled, taken out of you, and then, basically they find the best T cells that attack your melanoma and blow them up to about 60 billion and reinfuse them. Very personalized medicine, and very expensive personalized medicine. It's where the patient one blog comes from. I asked them how people have done on this, and they said, as far as we know, you're the first one to try these two immunotherapies with, sort of one, embedded in the other. So, my response to that was, well, hey, that's great. No one's ever failed this before. So,
right, exactly. You were patient number one. That explains the blog title.
It does.
I didn't know that.
That's a little background behind that. I have my very witty younger brother to thank for that one. And that kind of, my mindset, cancer patients have a variety of emotions that they attach to a diagnosis. And, I'm very fortunate that I had a lot of support, family and friends. I had people that were able to help me do research that pointed me in the right direction. Also had a background and maybe, a little bit something inside me that said, my son's not going to know my name in 2 years. He might remember a picture, but, I said, give me the best chance for a durable response. And if that didn't work, then, that wasn't going to be great, but I knew that I had kind of given myself or put myself in the position to have a response that might last. And I was extremely fortunate, had I come along, like Dr. Moore said a little while ago, 10 years or 15 years before, my options were much more limited, even 5 years before. So, I got into it knowing that my body, even though I had been in the hospital for 16 days at first and I had lost weight and lost strength, I had that part of me that said, okay, this is going to give my body a chance to fight the cancer itself. And when I failed that first trial, we continued to look at immunotherapies as options. And, the anti-PD-1 drugs, which were the plan B all along, we were able to find one here at a local cancer center right in Fort Lauderdale, a much smaller one than the nationally recognized one that I was at earlier. But they had the drug, and I will never forget the conversation that I had with the pharmacist who had done most of the research at that point, because it was very early on. It was the second trial for this particular PD-1 that they had put out there. And he said, this is so new, we don't really know much about it, but I would do everything. If it were me, I would do everything possible to keep your immune system functioning at a high level, because your immune system is what is ultimately going to be melanoma. And that's sort of always stuck in my mind, is this is how I need to adjust my lifestyle so that those little T cells inside of me are able to do their thing as best they possibly can.
And, that's interesting, because when I was at U of M, and again, my issue, I was stage two, and this was 10 years ago. Dr. Moyer was real clear about this, and so was Dr. Ludgate and Dr. Johnson, who is the head of the, who runs the clinic, if memory serves, at U of M, at the Multidisciplinary Melanoma Clinic. Shameless plug for some very good people. A friend of mine just had melanoma surgery there last week, and he came home just raving about how terrific everybody was. His is on his forehead, and he's afraid of looking a little bit like a freak, and we had to talk him down a couple different times about that. But you are essentially, TJ, the perfect patient. Would you agree with that, Dr. Moyer? He's doing it's not all the right stuff, correct?
I would agree. I mean, and I think one of the things that TJ really points out, I think, is critically important is this idea about clinical trials. I think it's really, really important that people who, when they do get a diagnosis, that they do investigate the options they have for clinical trials, because really it's the cutting edge treatments for the treatment of not only melanoma, but all cancers. And I mean, really one of the greatest advantages of going to a place that has a multidisciplinary approach is that you can avail yourself to all those different types of options. And it may not be a clinical trial at where you're at. It may be someplace else you need to go to, but at least you know about them and make those options available to patients.
I have a couple questions that we've had emailed in since we got you on the phone, Dr. Moyer, so I'm going to run these right past you. Somebody said, I've already had melanoma. What should I do to prevent a recurrence?
Well, I think that, you know, by far the most important thing is to be very, very cautious about sun exposure. I think there is some sense out there by people that they say, well, it's my exposure that happened, you know, 20 years ago or 15 years ago. It is cumulative, and so it's really important that you continue to take very, very good sun precautions. And then, as we've talked about earlier, I mean, you know, clearly surveillance is really, really important in those types of patients. Once you have a diagnosis, your chances of getting another one are greater. And so it's really, really important that you do your own self-exams, as well as be sure that you go to a certified or an experienced physician that looks at skin. That means that could be a dermatologist, that could be a family doc who just does a lot of skin, but you want someone that's knowledgeable in those types of screening. And you know, probably 20 or 30 years ago, one of the key things that people talked about, and we still talk about, is the ABCDE of melanoma.
Sure.
And that's kind of a nice mnemonic for people to kind of think about when they have a mole, if it's something they need to be worried about. And the A stands for asymmetry. B stands for border that are irregular. C is color when it gets darker or it gets kind of variegated and kind of difference in color within a mole. When the diameter gets bigger, that's the D. And then it's if it changes. So just a simple mnemonic can help people identify areas on their body that may be of a concern. And these are actually pretty good. They've actually stood the test of time, the ABCDEs of melanoma screening.
And to another shameless plug, I am certain that TJ, I haven't gone through all of his blog. I've read through a fair amount of it getting ready to do this show. I'm reasonably certain he has the photos of ABCDE up on his blog. Or if he doesn't, he probably will pretty soon. And I also have that in my book in one of the appendices as well. TJ, do you have that on your blog right now? Is that still up there?
You know what? It was in an early post, and I've been doing this now for almost 3 years, and I forget
right.
that, you know, when I write something that it needs to be reiterated. So I've tried to do it kind of every year approaching Memorial Day, you know, especially the Philadelphia area is where the readers are concentrated.
Yeah.
Throw that up there, and it's a reminder to get checked, and it's a reminder to check yourself out. So usually I'll link to it. I don't know if it's on the blog or not as a permanent link.
Okay.
But it's up there a couple different places.
All right, and Dr. Moyer, I have one here about scarring, and that certainly is something that you can speak to with a lot of expertise. I showed my surgical scar to a dermatologist at the Outrun the Sun 5K, and his nurse, they were there to do the run, and they were dumbfounded at how minimal the scar was, despite being nearly 8 inches long as it wrapped around the side of my head. So what do you do to minimize scarring? You're really good at this, so here, take it away.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with how large an area that needs to be removed. There are a lot of things that are just kind of inherent to a given patient. So, I mean, frankly, some patients, their skin just does better with scarring. And we have all seen types of patients where their scars can fade away really nice. You may have a friend or something, and you're surprised that they ever had anything done. Certainly, there's certain techniques that are really important to try to make sure that you can minimize scar. There's ways of closing, ways of rotating tissue around. And then it's just really being meticulous with following patients until you get a result that you're happy with, because it's not uncommon that we need to go back and do scar revision surgeries on patients. So when you're really trying to close an area that's fairly large, there's a lot of tension on a wound, and those cause poor scars. And so if you go back and do scar revision, you can do it in a way that you can camouflage scars, and you can make scars just look better. And there's other little tricks. There's laser, like you mentioned. You can do skin sanding. We call that dermabrasion, to kind of help scars blend in. So it's you know, you want someone that really is with you for the long haul. I mean, these are not just a kind of a one-and-done type of thing, not only from the standpoint, if you're the doctor that is following someone from the oncological standpoint, but if you're just the reconstructive surgeon, I mean, you really are following these patients to make sure that they heal the way that you would expect.
We've got about 4.5 minutes left, and I've got two more questions here, and these are closely related. What can I do to reduce my risks of developing another melanoma? I think you spoke to that, actually, about continuing to practice good sun hygiene. This one, here we go. I have been diagnosed with skin cancer. This is a big issue for a lot of people that I talk to. What is the risk of my family members developing melanoma? In other words, is there a genetic component to this, or is it primarily sun-related?
There's certainly a genetic component in the sense that you do see it track within families. Now, how much of that is skin type? So there's no question that people who are more fair-skinned, blonde, blue-eyed, red hair, are at greater risk. And now how much of that is just because their skin is just much more sensitive to sun damage, and how much of this is just maybe they're more inherently sensitive developing melanoma, it's kind of unclear. So trying to flesh out how much of it is skin type, how much of it is genetic, is difficult. But I think almost everyone agree that it does track within families, and so that if you do have a family member, first-degree relative that has a skin cancer, whether that's basal cell, squamous cell, or melanoma, that they should be much more diligent about checking their skin and having sun precautions.
TJ, we are coming down to the wire here. We just have a couple minutes left. Anything you'd like to share? Link to your blog, something like that, that we can – one last question for Dr. Moyer.
Oh, I think TJ dropped out. He just dropped out.
Oh, okay.
So,
all right, well
– yeah, I guess we are anyways reaching the end of the hour scheduled time. So I think he's not going to dial in again.
Okay.
So, thank you so much, Dr. Moyer, for your time. Thank you so much for, taking time out from your busy schedule to be with us today and educate us on such an important issue that is already affecting about 1 million Americans. And David, thank you so much for co-hosting the show with me so articulatively and brilliantly. And TJ, if you're listening, thank you so much for your time and inspiring us and our audience with your story and your very insightful questions. It was a very informative discussion indeed, and I hope it will serve as a useful resource for many out there looking out for authentic information on melanoma. And audience, I thank you for your support, and we look forward to having you all join us for our next Cure Talk on 31st October at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, where we will be discussing post-transplant outcomes in high-risk multiple myeloma patients. For more information on this show and other upcoming shows, visit our website, www.curetalks.com. And I would love to hear your feedbacks about Cure Talks and melanoma, and I would welcome your suggestions on the topic that you feel should be covered here on this portal. Please email your suggestions on shweta@trialx.com. The link for today's show will be sent in via email to all the participants, and the transcript will be made available within a few days. And before you go, please don't forget to check out the details of the AmericaWalks study. AmericaWalks is a mobile app-based research study which aims to determine walking behavior of individuals in the United States. And the last date to enroll in the study is 31st of October 2016. For more details about the study, please visit trialx.com/AmericaWalksStudy. So until the next show, thank you, everyone, and bye-bye.